put 50,000 cash money in the spot right here.
300 Quaker, probably in the spot.
They steal it, or they turn it to cash.
Okay, I'm on the northbound actor. Trying to light.
Look, I think, Carl, what the hell can be done? And I think we can set it up again.
If you like what you hear, go to ganglandwire.com. We need you to put a hit out on our donate button. Follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/ganglandwire. Follow true crime storyteller Gary Jenkins on Twitter at JenksLaw. Buy the DVD Gangland Wire or download the Kansas City Mob Tour app. And now, here's Gary Jenkins.
Good evening, folks. Glad to be back here in the beautiful studios, Studio 4, the Big Dumb Fun Show in the Ice House in Midtown Kansas City, just south of the end of the light rail line. It's just a few blocks north of us. Have you ridden the light rail line yet, Aaron? Say hello, Aaron.
Hello, Aaron. I got a chance to this last weekend.
Yeah.
Down at City Market.
Did you ride it?
I rode it.
What'd you think? It was too crowded for me to get on. What'd you think?
Well, it was crowded, and B, the streets were crowded with a lot of cars. So I took a ride around the City Market, and I got off because it was going to take a while, it seemed like, for it to, I don't know, during the week and how that works.
It's really slow,
but on
I
the
read.
Weekend, yeah, there's a lot of cars already down there.
Right, right. It doesn't really save a whole lot. That was all a big splash this last weekend. We'll see what happens. If you notice, the first thing Monday morning, the biggest foe of the light rail is Crosby Kemper from the library, because he doesn't like it that we're putting tax money into that and giving tax credits for the TIF credits for...
tax incremental financing.
Right, for buildings downtown when he wants the tax money for his library, which I understand that. It's a pretty important thing. But he took a picture at like 7:15 or 6:45 a.m. There was nobody on the light rail Monday morning. So it's probably been like that all week. I didn't take time to get out and take a look. But
well, I'm just wondering, when it comes down to the Union Station there,
yeah,
at Pershing and Main, it turns around and goes kind of reverses direction and goes back. But I mean, I know there's parking over there by Union Station. It's all feed parking.
It's all, yeah, you got to pay to park there.
So, I mean, if you wanted to, like, ride your car in and rather not pay the fees of downtown parking and park there and ride the light rail.
Well, it's a tourist train.
Yeah, they already have our money. So
yeah,
it's not about our money, really. It's about all the other people coming to Kansas
City. It's
the
tourists that are staying in the hotels money. That they want to get on it and go back and forth, I think. Or the young people that are out drinking. That's an entertainment district just north there, just like the old River Key used
to
be.
I didn't see how late it runs.
You know, I don't know. Sometime into the night. So you won't get picked up for drinking and driving if you're riding the light rail between the joints down in Crossroads District. So, you know, there's a boon. There's a plus. Anyhow, so let's talk about crime. Well, one thing I wanted to tell you, Aaron, you know, a couple of weeks ago, both you and I were on our way to the studio and there was a murder right over there by your house on Valentine.
Valentine and Bellevue.
And Bellevue or Southwest Traffic Way. And I had just come through there and you had just left from that area. And I found out yesterday what the deal was. Now, you remember our stories about Monty Ray Denman and we talked about Omar Little.
Mm-hmm.
Well, here's what the guy told me. He said, I asked him, I said, well, what's the deal with that guy that got killed over on the traffic way in Valentine? He said, robbing drug dealers is a dangerous business. I said, what do you mean? He said, that guy who got killed had gone to the penitentiary for some kind of a shooting and a robbery. And he was one of these guys that robs drug dealers.
And he'd gotten out.
He'd gotten out, but he had left a gun with a friend of his, and he was wanting to go back into the business, and he went to the friend of his to get the gun, and the friend wouldn't give it to him, and then that's as far as the investigation got that this guy knew about, and the next thing they know, he ends up shot in the head, and somebody, a man and a woman, drive off in some kind of a dark-colored SUV. So that's more will be revealed. I'll keep following that story since we're so personally involved in that one. Maybe we can have somebody come and talk about it one of these nights. So I just thought it was interesting, you know, he was a Monty Ray Denman type guy. And that's really dangerous, the guys that go out and steal from the criminals. And we're going to talk a little bit about people that steal from criminals tonight. in my prepared program. We got a couple other things to talk about. You know, folks, I put up, Aaron and I recorded two episodes. One's 30 minutes. Another one, I think, maybe is 40 or 45 minutes long. It's a little bit longer, and it's about surveillance techniques. And it starts out, I use real examples from surveillances I was on and how we did it. Mm-hmm. And the tools we used and on up to the modern times. In the second episode, I talk about a recent case that was in all the news where the FBI and some Kansas City police, I think robbery detectives, were using GPS locators and cell phone pinging to follow around an armed robbery crew and caught them and actually ended up in a shootout with one of them and killed one of them. So they are $1.99 each. Go to my shop page, and you can use PayPal or you can use your credit card. And I realize $1.99 on a credit card isn't very much, but you know I pay the little lug that PayPal costs you, so it doesn't cost any more than $1.99. It's pretty slick, and you buy the podcast, and I will send you the links. It's a way to help us raise money. We're trying to buy a new used laptop to use for our podcast that has a little more stuff in it. It's going to work a little better. We might get another microphone. And well,
we've got some Freedom of Information Act requests in.
We got some Freedom of Information requests.
The studio's not actually free, but the service I provide here at the Big Dumb Fun Show,
right,
which is available to anybody, although I'm pretty selective about who I like to work with.
Yeah. He likes to get paid. Now, I don't pay him unless we get some kind of donations or we sell
a premium episode.
We sell a premium episode.
That's why I got into saying, hey, let's go out and do this in public and charge people a ticket.
Yeah, and you know, we broke even on the last one. We made a little money on the first one, so that's a whole lot of work. That's the dollar, the hourly rate goes way down when you start doing those public episodes. But so, if each one of you guys, just each one of you, would buy one set of two segments of the premium episodes, it would help us immensely.
You'll find them in the shop page on the store for gamelandwire.com.
Right.
And or you could help Gary out by buying that app.
Yeah, you can buy the app. You know, I am still selling a couple, three every month.
Or you could rent the movie online from Amazon. Yeah. Gangland Wire.
Yeah, that's only I think it's $2.99 online. Or no, it's a dollar. No, it's only $1.99 online. So.
Or if you're a criminal and you want to come clean, so to speak.
Yeah, get a hold of us.
If you want to get your side of the story out, much like the episode we did with Craig Glazier, the King of Sting, author of The King of Sting, when we talk about drug ripoffs, we definitely like to hear from the experts.
And which gets us around to another interesting little tidbit. Aaron's got at least part of an email there that I forwarded to him. Sent him a screenshot or something. I don't remember. But
yeah, it seemed to be. Well, I don't know. I was able to copy paste it into a different email address.
So read so some of that, and then we'll tell people who that's from.
Well, so we had done an episode on hijacking airlines from the 70s. It was the 727.
I don't remember the exact.
It was a particular model, Boeing model, where you could exit out of the back of the plane because there was a door and a stairwell that would lower. And I remember that growing up. I would fly occasionally, and we'd go out the back of the plane there. Well, we did a series of episodes, and two episodes, I guess, and talked about hijacking, like D.B. Cooper. People know D.B. Cooper,
right,
probably the most famous.
And the year that D.B. Cooper did that, there was, I think, like six others. And the one we talked about that was the most interesting story and I could find the most information about was a man named Martin O'Malley. Martin McNally, who got caught. But go ahead, Aaron.
Yeah, so apparently Martin is...
He's released on parole.
He's been released on parole, according to his email that he sent us, in which he searched. I'll read this to you. It was sent to us on the 6th
actually,
of May.
What he did, he made a comment on the blog page on my website.
Was that what that
and
was?
And he leaves an email when he did the blog page and invited me to contact him and ask questions.
Well, so it's still on the comments? Because I know I looked the other day. You can look, sort the...
Yeah, it should be on the comments for the airline
blog.
Hijacking.
Okay.
And
I'll have to go back and look at
entry.
It there, but... So I guess he posted this comment about 10:30 at night. I just noticed your site as I searched myself on the web. So I listened to what you said about the case that happened in June of 1972. I laughed hard because many of the facts were wrong, but it was interesting, period. I'm out of prison on life parole, living in St. Louis, doing well after 37 years in federal maximum joints nationwide. Got out January 27th, 2010. And really lucky that I got out. At one point, my release date was June of 2082. If you have any questions. Well, we had questions.
We had questions. I emailed him right back. I'm waiting now to hear back from him. I hope we can get him. I asked him some questions. Like, for example, did you put a parachute on the money? Because we're sure they found the money intact laying there.
Yeah, he got separated from the money.
But
and then he additionally sends another comment. So the first one was at like 10:35. He immediately must have listened to the second episode.
Yeah.
It was 11:45 p.m. Listened to both episodes. Episode 2 is really funny. The farmer really wanted to keep the $500,000. It was his grandson, age 19, who said we should turn it in. The farmer did accept the $10,000. The informant in Detroit got $10,000 from the FBI. And good friend James Petty, who was my business partner, informed to the FBI, and I was arrested several hours after talking to him on June 28th of 72. This email from the Martin McNally.
Right. See, that's one of the facts I probably thought I got wrong, which I did, if he knows who the informant was, because I figured, and I said so in the podcast, I figured the informant was the guy named Walter Petlikowski, who came down to Indiana and picked him up and took him back to Detroit after he did the hijacking. His wife was talking to the police because she was trying to minimize Walter's sentence, and so I figured she was the one that ratted him out, but apparently it wasn't her. It was this guy here.
Yeah, James Petty.
So I don't know.
According to his email, he helped me from the start but was not indicted. At no time did I give the FBI any data about what happened. Several years ago, a reporter from The Riverfront Times in St. Louis contacted me about the case. I'm giving him my life story. But nothing can be published while I'm on life parole. I covered everything about the 37 years in federal max joints, including murders of inmates and guards, manufacturing of weapons, and numerous escape attempts. Was he the one that flew the helicopter? His girlfriend.
He was the one. Well, it was his buddy. He buddied up with a guy.
You gotta go back and listen to that episode, folks. You should go listen to that episode. If you're listening to this,
yeah.
When you're done listening to this episode, go back and listen to the hijack episode.
Yeah,
he
had buddied up with a guy who was like a real deal professional criminal, who kind of an international James Bond kind of a character. Who had got caught on his own aircraft hijacking? Only his was more. I don't remember about his now. Go back and listen to it. But that guy got his girlfriend to commandeer a helicopter to try to go up to
hijack a helicopter.
Yeah,
and fly in.
Hijacking.
That
yeah.
was what it was.
And to fly in and pick him and Martin McNally up. In the yard, but you know they were in the Merriam Supermax, and though it's really heavily constricted on how they can move around. Matter of fact, I emailed him one more time, and I told him about a friend of mine that I made who was recently released from the federal prison system, and he's writing a series of articles that are kind of exposés about the federal prison sentence, and so I sent him that guy's website and contact information and an example, a link to an article this guy did about some things that went on at Supermax. So I thought maybe I might hook those guys up.
Yeah, with McNally,
because they both live in St. Louis. My friend Seth Ferrante was declared a drug kingpin at age 22 and got 25 years in the penitentiary and did 24 of it and was just released recently. And while he was in there, he started publishing a blog. He wrote several true crime books. He was meeting these other drug kingpins in the prisons he was in, and he had some writing skills, and so he would get their life stories and he would write a book and then put it out through Amazon. And so he had four or five books published by the time he got out of the penitentiary. He's a really interesting guy. Well, he'll do a phone-in interview one of these days. He's in St. Louis, and you know he's got a good website. If you're interested in that, is www.gorillaconvict.com.
Maybe we can, if we happen to go over to St. Louis, which I was more than happy.
Yeah,
to
Aaron wants to go tape an interview with Mr. McNally.
Yeah, Mr. McNally, if you're listening to this, if you've listened to other episodes of the podcast, you wouldn't hear this one until much later, and hopefully we'll have heard back from you. But if not,
call us.
We'll come and visit you.
We'd
really like to come out to St. Louis and do a sit down and do just a specific episode really with you.
Yeah, we would.
I think if there's nothing else better than the words from the mouths of the men that did it.
That's true. So call us. Email me. Do anything. We want to talk to you again. Okay, let's move along. What we're going to talk about, I am so involved with this book that I'm doing, and I'm using the audio from the wiretaps. It's going to be a Kindle interactive book. So you'll be reading what the guy said, they'll be telling their own story on the page, and then you can click on a link and you can go to another site and hear the audio and read the text as they tell their story about their skimming. So I wanted to talk a little bit, we're talking about stealing from other criminals. You know, one time, Nick Savella in Kansas City, is the boss of Kansas City, he had two moles inside the Tropicana. Now, there's two separate streams of skim. So the other one was Lefty Rosenthal and the Stardust, which was, you know, the fictionalized characters in the Casino movie, which everybody knows, and that's the Tangiers Casino and Ace Rothstein. Well, that was the Stardust Casino and Lefty Rosenthal in real life. But at the same time, in the Tropicana Casino, and they didn't make a movie about the Tropicana, and they didn't even put the Tropicana skim investigation in or any of the people from the Tropicana in it. Just in kind of in general, they put them in the Tangiers in the Casino movie. But in the Tropicana, there were two people, one man named Joe Augusto, another man named Carl Thomas, and they were the Kansas City mobs, or Nick Savella's moles inside the Casino, and Carl Thomas particularly had been involved in skimming for a long time. He started out in Circus like 15 years before that, skimming for the mob, and he was Mr. Clean in Las Vegas. Nobody realized what he was and who his connections were. So while they are inside the Tropicana, they're starting to skim up and it's going pretty good, Nick Savella starts getting worried that some of the employees that are responsible to skim the money and send it back to Kansas City, you're taking some off the top. He didn't want anybody stealing from his skim at all.
Yeah, the people that are stealing for him need to give him all the money.
They got to give him all the money. I mean, they get a little bit. You know, he's happy to give them a little bit, but they can't take $3,000 or $4,000, you know, on their own and stick it in their pocket and walk out. And he was afraid they'd be doing that, and he was probably right. And they probably were a little bit.
It would seem like it would be pretty hard not to.
It'd be hard not to. You're already stealing it. So it's kind of like the restaurant that shuts down, and you know that it's going out of business next week, and all of a sudden all the decorations disappear from the wall, and the extra food that has any value and booze and everything all of a sudden starts walking out the front door. So you know, I'm sure they were.
Well, and these were two separate skims. One was the one that with Lefty Rosenthal that didn't go to Kansas City, that went to Chicago, right, and then was distributed from there.
Correct.
And then there was a second one that Chicago didn't know about.
That Chicago knew about it.
They did?
Yes. Nick Savella had it going all on his own. Chicago knew about it because he voluntarily sent a little piece of it, say $10,000 a month, up to Chicago. He didn't have to because they didn't really help him make the inroads on the casino. They only got control of the Stardust because the four Midwest mafias, the Milwaukee, Cleveland, Chicago, and Kansas City, colluded and put pressure on the Teamsters Union through their four different contacts and highly placed contacts in the Teamsters Union and got the Teamsters to loan Alan Glick, the owner of the Stardust, the money to buy the casino. And then out of that, they told him, okay, we got you that money. Now you got to hire Lefty Rosenthal and then let him do what he wants. Yeah, and
that's
how
they controlled the Stardust.
Right. And then he'll control it. And he does what we tell him to do. And he then sets up the skim. And then they set, and the owner doesn't know anything about it by design. He doesn't want to know anything about it. He was glad he got the money. Now, the Tropicana was different.
And actually, we had talked about that. We have a couple episodes up, don't we, about the Teamsters Union.
Yeah, Nick Savella.
And how they put together the key people that they had to get the loan.
Right.
So if you go back through some of the podcast episodes, you'll find that out there as well.
I think it was Nick Savelle and the Teamsters that where we talked about. Name the people that they controlled. Each one of those different families controlled a different high-level Teamster. Yeah. Teamster. So now, coming back to this story, and there's a famous scene in the film Casino, and I have I made a little video to put up to kind of compare and contrast the a scene from the movie Casino and the real life audio tapes when they're kind of discussing the same things. And in this, they're discussing whether somebody is stealing money from the casino in the film Casino. And then we'll click to Carl Thomas and Nick Savella talking about this particular problem. So go ahead and play that clip. It says Skim Casino Bench.
That the money we're robbing is being robbed, that somebody's robbing from us. We go to all this fucking trouble, and somebody's robbing us.
Like I said, you know, it's part of the business. It's considered leakage.
Leakage my balls. I want the guy who's robbing us.
Defeats the whole purpose of what we're doing out there.
You know, they take this money because they're my guys.
Carl Thomas tries to impress Nick with his scheming, even around his kitchen table.
Me, Frank, and Shutter, and my bookkeeper, Michael Troy, who is 1,000% been with me for 15 years, has sat around in my kitchen, thank you, for 6 hours, taking ways to beat these joints, because I like to take money out of them. These guys go back there, open the box, and snatch the cash. I've used that system for as long as I can get it. There is no record. They take the money, they go to the office, count it down, boom, 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 boom. Man, the bad part about that system, if they say they're taking $2,000 a day, they could be taking $2,400.
Yeah, how do you, if they go in and pick up, how do you know they pick up $7,000?
Nick, I only know it because the guy's been with me 15 years and always know what I told him. I just can't believe this guy would do this.
Give him off $40,000 a week in dollars and grab the $40,000 C notes, and nobody knows, but you just keep, when I said a key, y'all mean a big key, your room's not much bigger than the corner. They have their own bank room. You can do that very easily.
Really?
I remember one night at Circus Circus, we had an obligation to meet. When I was younger, I had one ball right there. There was two guys that stayed outside. Bobby was one of them. And I was in out of my fucking bag, thanks to that money. They weren't far from me. That refrigerator put money in my pocket, too. I think if you do things out in the open, you stare a guy right in the face.
Now, the first part of that was actually from the movie Casino.
The first one was several of the mob bosses sitting around worrying about leakage or somebody stealing from the skim. And then the second part was Carl Thomas talking to Nick Savella about how they skim. And, you know, he said there's really no way. You just got to trust your guys.
Where did they record that at? Do you know?
That was up at the Josephine Marlowe house. It was the famous Marlowe tape, the famous Marlowe meeting in which Joe Gasto and Carl Thomas came back from Las Vegas and particularly circuitous manner and tried to be extra secretive so nobody would see them. And they spent about 6 hours that day talking in front of an FBI microphone. Everything you ever wanted to know about infiltration of a casino and skimming from a casino.
Because, I mean, I've heard other audio. We've got it in some of like the intro clip.
Yeah.
And it's not nearly that good.
Yeah, I mean it's a microphone. It's uneven. It's always uneven.
Sometimes you know when it's a telephone tap, it's you know it has a different kind of a
right
texture and sound to it.
Telephone tap is more even. That you have in the intro that you guys can hear just a little bit in the background is complaining about how if you get silver, it weighs too much money. So they didn't really want to skim silver. They wanted to or it weighs too much. They want to skim dollar bills. And that's what he was explaining. He'll explain later. All this will be in my book. In detail, it'll be in my book. I take those audio clips and then explain them out and then let you listen to them.
And then you can actually read it because that's in the Kindle book as well.
Right, You can read the actual transcript. You can read my explanation of the transcript. And then you can click on a link and you can go and you can actually listen to it.
Now, if you download the Kansas City Mob Tour app, can you go to where the house is at?
Yeah, you can. I've got the Marlowe house on there. It's right up in the Nick Savella neighborhood. So that's a little bit of compare and contrast it and them talking about skimming and leakage and all that. They just, what he did, what Nick did during this time, he did a moratorium on skimming in order to try to figure out if anybody was stealing from him. Carl Thomas was given the job to do an audit, and so they stopped skimming and they did an audit. During this time, also, Joe Augusto was from Sicily originally. He was probably in the United States illegally, and nobody really could ever figure out exactly who he was. They kind of figured out who he was, but he had another birth certificate and another name, and so nobody really knew exactly who he was. Oh, speaking of people contacting me, his niece caught hold of me one time and made a comment on my YouTube channel about that was her uncle and how she always thought a lot of him. And he was a nice guy. When he ended up coming to witness for the government, and I talked to some of the agents that babysat him, and he was a great guy. He was a lot of fun, and he wasn't, you know, dangerous or crazy or anything. He was a con artist is what he was.
Isn't there was some video out there where he's telling the story about how they're hassling him, and he's got his dishwasher job at the casino.
Yeah, he said something about, what am I? I'm a mob. I'm connected to the mob. What does that mean? He said, all I got's a dishwasher job here at the casino. I'm no mob guy. He was a scammer. He was a ace number one scam artist.
How did you explore it all in the book? How they, because it was a separate skim from the Stardust.
Right.
And the Stardust skim was set up because they got the money from the Teamsters Union to build the casino.
No, that was, the Stardust.
The Stardust.
Right, right.
Now, the Tropicana, they didn't do that.
No, they did the opposite, actually.
They just, broke into the management?
Yeah. What happened was it was owned by a lady, had bought into it, named Mitzi Stauffer Briggs. She was an heiress from some chemical company. She had more money than she knew what to do with, and somebody convinced her that she ought to buy the Tropicana. It was owned almost wholly by a guy named Deal Gustafson, who was a businessman out of Minnesota, I think. And Gustafson was probably a little bit morally ambiguous, shall we say, when his business dealings, and he ended up catching a case for kiting checks. He and Joe Augusto. Joe Augusto started kiting checks with him. And why they did this, Mitzi, Joe was able to con her, to make her believe that he was an important person that could help her run the casino. He didn't have a casino license, never could get a casino license because he had a felony conviction from when he was young. He was given the job as a manager of the Folies Bergère, which was one of the early, there's the Lido show, Lido de Paris, mm-hmm, at Stardust, and there was a Folies Bergère show. And those, if you remember back in the 70s when the casinos, 60s and started, when the casinos, they started with these kind of risque, naughty but nice
stage shows
with topless, beautiful topless women dancers. They could all dance. They were real deal dancers, and they were really high quality entertainment. And so Joe said he was the entertainment director, and he managed the Folies Bergère show. And so that gave him free run the casino. And he just conned him into thinking that he could help run the casino. And they believed him, and then
he brings in Carl Thomas.
He gets Carl Thomas a job there. He also is kind of reverse sting, shall we say. Maybe not sting's not the right word, but they did a little reverse thing from the Stardust case where they encouraged the Teamsters Union to get a loan to Alan Glick. In this case, the Tropicana, just before Mitzi Stauffer Briggs came in, Gustafson was about to lose it. Joe tells him that, maybe you ought to try the Teamsters. They're making casino loans. And then he tells Nick Savella, this guy needs money really bad. So Nick Savella gets the Teamsters loan turned down. So then he's really hurting. He's about ready to go out of business.
Well, because they have no control over the team. Nick has no control of the Teamsters.
Yeah.
I guess to tell him to say no to the loan.
Yeah, he didn't have to.
Because he wants to get somebody else separate from the Teamsters to...
What he wanted to do was to put them in a pinch. And then Joe Augusto looks like the savior. So Joe Augusto says, okay, let me keep working on this. I think I can get this done for you, this Teamsters loan. I know you didn't get it the first time. In the meantime, he teaches Gustafson a little trick on kiting checks between. He'll set up different accounts for different parts of the casino, the Folies Bergère account, the restaurants accounts, then they got the casino accounts, you know, you got the hotel accounts. So he started floating big checks between those two accounts. And when one would come due and they're about ready to turn it back, they would then write another check from one of the other accounts, and they kept it afloat with that. He showed him
separate
how to keep
banks.
With separate banks. He showed him how to keep it afloat during that. They ended up catching a case on that by the end of this thing, but that kept him afloat. So Joe became invaluable, and then he was promising that he was going to deliver the Teamsters loan eventually, which made him even more invaluable, and he just wormed his way in.
And then he was able to get this heiress. Or was that somebody that
I don't know where she came from. She came out of nowhere. Somebody, you know, maybe he did. I've not found anybody that really knew exactly
how it was that she suddenly comes.
All of a sudden, she shows up and she's got the money, and she ends up becoming the 90% owner. But he's already in, and he gets her confidence, and so he's able to continue in a position of power and authority at the casino, even though he doesn't even have a license. He can't get a license. They don't know that. And the gaming commission, he's stayed off their radar, so he stays low. That's one reason he was getting so anxious about Lefty Rosenthal. They were after him, and he had the same thing. He had the entertainment director's job, and they were saying, "No, you're connected to the mob. That you know that's
you can't actually
you can't
that.
Do that." There's
but
a
did
whole.
Lefty have any felony convictions?
Yeah, Lefty did too.
That was why he couldn't get a gaming license either.
Yeah, plus there's all kinds of intelligence about how he was connected to the mob, so the FBI was burning him all over the place.
And where did Carl Thomas come from?
Well, he had just been worked his whole life in the casino business. He had
he
worked.
Just happened to be like he was in Vegas, and
he just worked his way up. Started out probably as a dealer or something, and worked his way up into management. And he got noticed by Alan Dorfman in the 70s when they made a I don't know, like a $20 million, $30 million loan the Teamsters did to a guy named Jay Sarno, who owned the Circus Circus, which was this real family-oriented casino. If you remember, they have a circus for kids. So the kids could go up and go to the circus, see circus acts, and play arcade games and everything, while the parents directly below
are gambling.
And you can see, you know, it's like you could be up in the circus and see the gambling floor, and you can be down the gaming floor and see up into the circus.
Yeah.
So it's a real family kind of a place, and one of the you know early real family-oriented places in Las Vegas. And they needed that Teamsters loan, and Alan Dorfman then got Carl Thomas the job in there, and his job was to skim money and send it back. If you remember in that clip, he tells a story about when he was young and had balls. He was at the Circus Circus, and he had what he called an obligation to make, and that's what that means is they've got to skim so much.
There's required
to skim so much and get it back to Chicago to kick back to Alan Dorfman and some of the mob guys that got him that loan, got this Jay Sarno that loan. See, the casino, people don't understand this. Casino doesn't care. The owner does not care. He gets a casino. He's making some action. He could not have gotten that loan, so he's giving them money under the table in order to get the loan. He couldn't have got the loan.
Mm-hmm.
So he doesn't care if they skim money from him. He just looks the other way.
But the question here, I mean, because what we were really talking about was the skimmers skimming themselves.
So now the skimmers are skimming themselves.
How can you tell the difference? I mean, if you put a moratorium on skimming.
So that's what Nick did. He put a moratorium on skimming.
And go back, and now the casino says, wow, suddenly we're making another, you know, $8,000 a week.
Exactly. But Carl Thomas, see, he's in such a powerful position in the Tropicana, he can monitor this and massage all this and explain everything. Because the receipts do go up and down, and I don't know the exact nobody really knows the exact details, but, you know, he kept telling Nick, he said, you know, they're not stealing from you. They're my guys. They are not stealing from you. And Nick didn't believe it until he did the moratorium, and they did a moratorium for about 2 or 3 months, and then they kicked it back in again because Thomas, you know, from his audit.
It seemed like they were. The difference, but it seemed like they were.
They weren't.
They were not.
No.
Because, you know, when you figure out what the difference is between what you were making and what you're making now, and how does that, they know the accounting on the monies that go back to Kansas City. Like, they know how much it is, right?
They know they wanted $40,000 a month.
Yeah.
Now, during that time, Joe Augusto, he came up with about $40,000 every month in other ways. Maybe he took some up from the Folies Bergère. He took some up from the restaurant accounts, from the hotel accounts.
He just for himself.
No, for the to send back to okay. continue the skim. But they weren't skimming from the casino. But he was
during those other couple months.
He was stealing from right. He was stealing from other areas of the casino, but not from the casino itself, because Nick Civella wanted a moratorium on that skimming. It's crazy, I know. Yeah,
but they didn't want to stop having money coming.
But they didn't want to stop having money coming. I don't know if he did that. Nobody knows if he did that. I think he did that all on his own to show how important he was. But he got it done. Why don't we play this other clip? This is a much longer clip, but it's pretty clear. And it gives you a little, it's Joe Augusto talking to the underboss of Kansas City, Carl Tuffy DeLuna. And they start off talking about asking somebody that called two Picardo, he uses an Italian for the shepherd. This guy's name was Don Shepherd, and he had worked with Carl Thomas for a long time. So they start off talking about, we ask him another question, and DeLuna, who that means is he's asking Carl Thomas. We ask him if two Picardo, the shepherd, was capable of spotting any bad leakage. Augusto says, yeah. He says he positively thinks so because we used him. We used this guy with us down at the big place with Crazy. That would be the Stardust with Lefty Rosenthal. So go ahead and play that second clip. I'll explain more after we get done.
They talk for quite a long time. You know, I'm not sticking my mouth in there too much, but once in a while. And in the final end, Gio asked him, what do you think? He happens to see. He says, well, I think that maybe you should go ahead and declare this moratorium. Go ahead and do it for whatever period of time. And Mr. Seal says, well, we talked. It would be hard on time. You know, I'm not Little Joe Caesar's requesting this to tell him not to. You know, we rely on Mr. C to tell us. Another question. We ask him if the bigger otter was capable of spotting any bad leakage.
Yeah.
He says he positively thinks so because if we used him, this guy was Kunaratri down at the big place with Crazy. He said we used him down there. He did a wonderful job. Had him in both joints. The other one downtown had him in both. He said he did a good job. Yes, he is capable. We pushed on him that when he gets with you, when you two get together, that he should try to push you. We know how busy you are in and out of town, but to try to get to meet you once a week, like we've been talking about, you know?
Right.
Someplace away, not his joint or your joint.
Right.
Some little coffee someplace else. Also, we'll put it in his head to put in your head that look forward to, let's see if we could work out the mechanics of a safe, discreet way that Caesar and Mr. C could sometime in the next couple of months have a nose-to-nose meeting with Mr. Seal. Let's start thinking about it now. Let's say the moratorium is going to last 2-3 months, whatever it lasts, you know, 4 months, whatever it is. Before the end of the moratorium, a month or so before the end, see if we could start thinking about it right now for a safe, discreet way for Mr. C and Mr. Caesar to meet with the CEO.
All right.
Okay? So he's supposed to tell you these things.
I like the arrangement. Tell us here. I want to thank you to everybody. Excellent decision, because I think it's a proper decision.
Here's another thing that he said. He said that Caesar and Picardo get along real well together. They have a nice relationship with each other. And he knew that you two guys were together.
Yeah.
That is Caesar and Picardo. And he knew of some exchange of dialogue between you two. And one of you said that this is should be a $50 million joint or something like that. I forgot the words. And if Picardo answered, yeah, but it's got a $30 million management. They're not happy, truly happy with the management.
Yeah.
So Mr. C put the bum on Teal.
Yeah.
Is it possible that Caesar could see his way clear to giving Picardo a little bit more say-so? He says, you know, with the news
So Theo says, well, what are you talking about, Carl? What we ought to do. I don't care if it's the car dealer. I don't care if it's Little T, the guy you told me about the black book.
Right.
I don't give a fuck who they are, Joe.
Yeah.
If you want to delegate the power to Bicolato, or you want to see to it it gets done some other way, if he knows that some friend of Little T, say for instance, he knows for sure he's stealing. Fuck him. Let him go.
I told him that.
Okay.
You and him had that down. I told him that anybody that he has, he don't have it to ever prove, but anybody has a 50-50 suspicion, let him go. Because in this type of business, you cannot take the chances. If you got a 50% suspicion, let it go. But not to put a jacket, you know, on those bases to people only because they are a friend of the Domano, Little T, whatever I love with Domano, whatever it is.
Okay.
We have gotten a long way. Yeah, administration. He has done because you never know those some of those fucking people they could be farming, you know what I mean? They could be store pigeon too, you know what I mean?
Right, yeah,
I just paused it there for a moment because he says the where was it at here? You never know though. Could be some of those fucking people, they could be Vani.
Those are hollow, empty shells in Sicilian. Empty suits.
They could be stool pigeons.
Yeah. You never know.
And Augusto is the guy with the very strong Italian accent.
Correct.
There.
Tuffy's the other one.
And Picolato.
That's a guy named Don Shepherd, who is one of their main skimmers, who Carl Thomas brought in to help him skim.
Now, why do they call him Picolato?
Because that in Sicilian is the shepherd.
Oh, okay.
Like you're a guy
that's
that has sheep.
For the shepherd.
Yeah. Actually, Sicilian.
Sicilian, yeah. Because actually. Because
Augusto was from Sicily. Another interesting thing about that segment back there, they talked about the car dealer and Little T, and they didn't care if it was a car dealer, Little T, or some friend of theirs. That is, the car dealer was a guy named Joe Cusimano, and he is a good friend and mob associate of Little T, who was Tony Splatro. So obviously, you know, Tony Splatro was supposed to be, you know, the king, the mob king of Las Vegas, what some people would have you believe. But obviously, Tuffy DeLuna was not scared of Tony Splatro because he said, you know, fuck him. If some friend of Little T's is stealing, get rid of him.
Yeah.
Which is the Joe Pesci character in Casino.
And Joe Pesci ends up dying.
He ends up dying later on. It wasn't Tuffy that killed him. It was some of his buddies up in Chicago because he screwed that all up. He brought down too much heat. All the way through, and all these wiretaps, you can tell Nick Savella does not want heat. It's really fascinating to listen to him, how far he'll go and how careful he is and how worried he is about any kind of public exposure to them or their activities or anybody's connected to them. There's a whole chapter in the book just on Lefty Rosenthal and the heat he's bringing down in public and how upset Nick is and how he figures out a way to reach out and talk to Lefty. Now, he doesn't threaten him. He knows better than that, but he does talk to him.
Now, this is also audio that's going to be in the Kindle.
Correct.
I was replying this back if you listen to the episode and then you want to hear more.
I actually have more there.
There's still
I'll
like
put
another
this,
minute and a half or so.
In the show notes, I'll put this transcript in the show notes.
You want me to continue the tape?
Yeah, go ahead. I think it's kind of interesting.
Something I had on my mind. I believe that I know what you're going through, and I know it probably even more than you think I do, and I wanted to tell you, I wonder if you regret having told Mr. Transmission and Mr. Hunter. Remember when you told me that you told them your intentions of the Zuta stuff?
Yeah.
I wonder if that wasn't kicking back in your face now.
Those guys forgot about it.
I'm just pause that for a moment. I'm trying to. Mr. Transmission is.
So here's this is Joe Augusto Tuffy's asking him if he regrets telling Mr. Transmission and Mr. Hunter of intentions about the SUTA stuff. SUTA is Sicilian for underneath stuff, which means the kickback money or the skim money. Mr. Transmission is a guy named Jack Ulrich, who is a minority owner in the casino, and Mr. Hunter is Dil Gustafsson, who is one of the other minority owners of the casino that I talked about earlier.
That they'd acquired the casino from.
Dil Gustafsson had it originally. Mitzi Stauffer Briggs came in, and she bought the biggest piece of it. This Jack Ulrich had come in, and he had invested money in it. He is one of the owners, and then Mr. Hunter, Dil Gustafsson, is an owner who is there all the time, but he's a minority owner. But Mitzi Stauffer Briggs, you got to understand, she was like their patsy. She ended up, it's really crazy. She puts like, I don't know, $20 million in this thing. Everybody else ends up with money.
So she brought in the money.
She brought in, she invests a lot of money, and these guys are minority owners, but she was a patsy for them. She ends up, there's several articles out there that where she got interviewed late in life. She blows through all that money, ever since she had, she lost in this whole Tropicana deal. She ends up, she's like 75 years old, working as a hostess in a buffet restaurant in Las Vegas and living off of that little bit of money in Social Security, and dies penniless.
Wow.
Basically.
Now, so DeLuna's basically saying, Tuffy DeLuna's saying that we've told these other minority partners that we're skimming.
Right.
Joe Augusto's like, yeah.
Yeah. He said, you told him that. Are you worried about it? Are you concerned and about the SUTA stuff? And, you know, he says, you know, they forgot about it. Now, he gives a kind of a double message there, because later on he'll say, DeLuna say something about, well, they could be thinking that Caesar's already doing this. Caesar is Joe Augusto. Said, you know, because the bookkeepers are probably got them bugged to death, like the bookkeepers are telling them that, you know, they're losing money. And Joe says, well, I think they might say that, but I've assured them there's nothing involved underneath. But yet just earlier he said he told them that they were skimming money. So that's a typical Joe Augusto explanation. It's crazy. It doesn't make sense. He does a lot of things that doesn't make sense, but he just goes through life. Go ahead and finish it off.
I hope so. You can see what's going through my mind, can't you? When you had that small dialogue with them, whenever you had it a few months ago, they could be thinking, Jesus Christ, Caesar's doing this already. You know, because the bookkeepers have probably got them bugged to death, too. You know?
Well, I think they might say that, but I assure them there was nothing involved. I don't think I'm just
kidding. Okay. So that's kind of the story of the leakage and the compare and contrasting of casino segment on skimming from a casino. They don't really go into that big time, a little bit, but not big time. There's a huge big story out there and several great stories about the skimming activities, and I'll go into a lot of those in my book. There was one in the Stardust. Lefty set them up. I talked to these FBI agents that work out there, and it's the famous cookie story. So they spot the guy they think is getting the skim
from the casino,
from the Stardust, and taking it back to Chicago. And they probably did have the right guy. And they followed him once, and he had a big sack, and he got in a car, and they followed him around. Then he went to the airport, and they caught him in Chicago, and they followed him to one of the mob boss's houses in Chicago.
So they didn't arrest him.
No, they didn't arrest him. They didn't really have anything on him right then. They just knew he was, they suspected that he was the courier, and probably Lefty, since he was their top echelon informant inside, probably told him he was a courier. So the next time, about a month later, they were getting this skim money about once a month from each place. The next time the guy's out there, the FBI gets all set up on him, and they're going to take him off. They're just going to go snatch him with this sack and grab the money and think that that's somehow going to make their case for them. And it probably would with some of this wiretap stuff we had out of Kansas City. So they follow the guy around. He gets a sack. He gets in his car. He drives off. He goes to, I think, the airport parking lot or somewhere in Las Vegas. I can't remember exactly. I probably shouldn't say. They stop him, or they get him. He stops, and they walk up to him and identify themselves, and they grab the sack, and there's nothing in there but cookies, Italian cookies. The great cookie keeper. He knew. I think Lefty ratted him out. I really think Lefty ratted him out. He He had to be an expert at riding that wire where he didn't go too far and he kept everybody off of his butt. Oh, yeah, that was those same guys told me the story about the
we don't actually want to lose any of the skim money to something like a bust like that, because then you have to go back and he's got to skim some more. Well, yeah, you got to tell the guys in Chicago that the money got nabbed in a bust.
Yeah.
And then they may not believe you.
No, you better get some big headlines. Dope dealers have this happen all the time. You know, if you say that somebody robbed you or the police busted you and took all your money or all the dope, you better be ready to provide a police report or some headlines or something, or nobody's going to believe you.
Yeah.
Just figure you stole it. Nobody trusts anybody in this world, this crazy underworld. I think we've pretty well done it for the night. Kind of interesting little tidbits of wiretap information and compare and contrast with casino. And I'll do a lot more of that in the book. The whole book will be nothing but that kind of stuff.
Original wiretaps.
With all the original wiretaps. I've got, I don't know, hundreds of hours of those things. Awful lot of them. I'm not even using because they're redundant. They keep saying, discussing the same situations over and over again. So you can only say the same thing so many ways and it would make it boring. So I'm just picking out the best clips to tell the story about the investigation. I'm doing it in chronological order, where I'm up to just before the Marlowe meeting, which is the famous meeting where they sit down and explain to Nick Savella exactly how you skim.
And that's actually probably the meat of the...
Yeah, that'll
case
be the
case that they caught.
That was it. When they got that, they had the case made. And it was a matter of that. It was just kind of tying up loose ends and starting to put the case together. And then they took them down. That was in November of 1978. And February of 1979, they served the search warrants and took everybody down.
You know, you have a favorite nonprofit.
Oh, I do. You know, I'm forgetting my... God.
If you have a friend, a loved one... A co-host.
Yeah, a co-host.
A relative.
Let me get some of this water. That's water, folks, that you hear every once in a while. That is not booze.
Who has a problem, an addiction problem, with drugs, alcohol, sex, gambling.
Make first call, your first call. Call 816-361-5900. Or you're from outside of town, go to www.firstcallkc.org.
Remember to download the Kansas City Mob Tour app, so you can take your smartphone and take a drive to many of these notorious gang locations in Kansas City while you listen to Gangland Wire Crime Stories podcast.
Yeah, you can sit right outside the Marlowe house and listen to some of the audio from inside that house. Now, that would be fun, I think, folks. Just don't get out and walk up to those houses. There's some of those people.
Family members
still live there. I had one guy that did that, and he got in an argument with somebody. So just drive by is the best policy.
Take a photo, maybe, but don't knock on the door. Don't ring the bell.
Right.
Don't go through the mailbox.
Don't get out in the yard and take the photo either.
Just stay in the car.
Really? Say goodnight, Aaron.
Goodnight, Aaron.
Goodnight.
Music provided by Odd-O-Matic. Follow them on Twitter at Odd-O-Matic Music.